Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, Broadcom's Qualcomm acquisition is crushed, the many ways that online porn is being threatened by legislation, the rise and then the fall of Theranos, and the passing of a brilliant mind and future thinker, Stephen Hawking. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 23, recorded Thursday, March 15th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform. Cloud Spanner is the only horizontally scalable and strongly consistent relational database service. To learn more, visit g.co/getspanner today.
Welcome to the show. This is the place where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Do we start by wishing you a happy birthday?
Oh,
maybe. Maybe a little bit of that. Yes, it is your birthday, right?
It is my birthday.
Okay,
Ides of March happens every year.
That was almost as awkward as me staring at a phone. The reason I'm staring at the phone is because I went ahead and made you an AR emoji balloons.
That is the sweetest gift.
You know.
Or part of a gift.
Nothing but the best for you, Megan.
Can you even send it to me?
Yeah, so that you can hang it on your wall.
Yeah, I'm totally going to.
All right, there you go. It kind of looks like me, I guess, right? Kind of, sort of. Anyways.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes, I am halfway to 90, and I've never felt better.
Oh, good. Well, I'm happy that you're here on your birthday. Actually, I'm not. I'm kind of sad about that, to be honest, but happy birthday.
I will just stay here at 45 until you catch up.
Okay.
Sound good?
Okay. Sounds good. San Diego-based Qualcomm is an industry staple when it comes to smartphone chips and has been instrumental in the development of 5G technology here in the U.S. Asian chipmaker Broadcom has been pursuing a buyout of Qualcomm since at least last November when it offered $103 billion for the transaction. And now U.S. President Donald Trump has squashed any possibility of the deal on grounds of a possible threat to U.S. national security. Joining us to pick these pieces apart, see what it all means, is Roger Chang from CNN. How's it going, Roger?
Hey, how's it going? Happy birthday, Megan.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. It's great to get you back. So first of all, with this, as far as the story is concerned, was there any indication back in November when we started kind of hearing about all this Qualcomm Broadcom stuff that the Trump administration might want or be interested in interfering so directly with the acquisition?
No, there was actually very little indication. Broadcom CEO Hock Tan actually went to D.C., sort of made the rounds. Kind of promised that Broadcom would actually be moving back to the U.S., something President Trump had proudly proclaimed, really all in a bid to make sure this deal went through. So as far back as November, it was tough to tell that there'd be trouble, this much trouble.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the trouble. What is the driving force behind this deal getting squashed? You know, we've heard that it kind of hinges around U.S. national security. What is the threat there?
Well, I mean, the threat ultimately goes back to Huawei, which obviously has had a lot of drama getting phones here in the U.S. Huawei has been pouring tons of money into investing into 5G and what 5G will look like in the coming years. And I think the idea that a Singapore-based company, Broadcom, coming in to scoop up Qualcomm and potentially reducing the investment, reducing the work that Qualcomm was putting into 5G was enough to be deemed a potential national threat and justified the executive order by President Trump.
So this was supposed to be the biggest deal in technology history. What happens now that, I mean, I know they're obeying the presidential order. So what next?
So Broadcom had already announced plans to move to the U.S. That is still in place. From everything I've heard and from what most analysts suspect, Broadcom will continue to try to buy more companies. There'll probably be smaller acquisitions. They have shown a knack for buying companies and sort of lifting their individual values. So I wouldn't be surprised if Broadcom went on a buying spree of its own. But for now, Qualcomm will remain independent.
And that was actually one of my questions that I had for you, but it's interesting to hear, you know, Broadcom had planned, and I think we heard about those plans days before this deal was completely crushed, had their plans to move the headquarters to the U.S. But you're saying that they're still planning on doing that. Is that just because that will help facilitate some of these other kind of potential acquisitions down the line? And if that's the case, I mean, are they going to encounter similar resistance in deals like that going forward? Maybe they aren't as big as this one, but will they just have to get used to this kind of resistance?
Well, I think that is one reason why they'd want to move to the U.S., because right now they're based in Singapore. They were under the jurisdiction of the Committee for Foreign Investment in U.S. or CFIUS. And it was CFIUS that ultimately made its recommendation to the White House to squash the deal, which is actually highly unusual. CFIUS usually doesn't step in until a deal is actually struck. And the fact that they kind of came in early kind of underscores, I guess, the importance of 5G to this administration and to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So the deal's all about 5G. I mean, how is 5G different than 4G and 3G? I know it's just the fifth generation. There's no 5G. It's not actual Gs of anything. This is, I've learned. So how is it different?
It's an extra G, so it's got to be better, right?
It's right. One better, right?
I know. They're obviously telling me it's better, but is it?
it's a much bigger jump from 4G to 5G than 3G to 4G. With 4G, we all got better speeds. We went basically from a dial-up connection to a broadband connection. That was great. That also created a whole bunch of new apps, right? Like Uber and Airbnb, a whole ecosystem of apps we didn't even think was possible. The 5G is supposed to change things even more. That's because beyond speed, it's supposed to be a lot more responsive, and it's a lot more, and it's capable of connecting more devices cheaper. So this whole idea, this trend of Internet of Things, of autonomous driving, even things like streaming virtual reality, all that can be enabled by 5G. A lot of folks call 5G sort of the foundational technology for a lot of these other different trends.
Now, I mean, I feel like we talk a lot about how Broadcom, you know, is probably heavily disappointed in light of this news. But what about Qualcomm? Is there any indication about how Qualcomm feels about the possibility or about the reality that an acquisition of their company is no longer possible, at least in the case of Broadcom? Do we know where they stand?
Yeah, at least internally, they're thrilled, right? This was a hostile takeover attempt. Qualcomm, at least initially, didn't want a merger at all, didn't want a deal. And then towards the end, I think they kind of softened up to the idea of a merger, but only for a much higher offer than what was on the table. So I think staying independent is for internally a positive. And I think for a lot of folks in the industry, it's considered a positive because this will allow Qualcomm to continue investing into 5G, into new technologies. I think from an investment perspective, it's a little bit dicier. Qualcomm is, while 5G is this great promise down the line, Qualcomm is facing pressure with smartphone market essentially peaking and slowing down. And I think there are a lot of questions about where Qualcomm gets growth in the next few years. Like a lot of companies, you know, Intel, the various carriers, everyone's looking to 5G as this sort of shining beacon of hope for growth and money and profits and everything. But that's not all going to come right away. We're in a very sort of early stage of 5G, and like the ramp up isn't going to happen for a while. So in the meantime, I think there are a lot of questions about where Qualcomm gets its growth.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the big fears in, you know, as this deal was potentially ramping up, was this idea that Broadcom would acquire Qualcomm and then totally slow down its U.S. development of the technology that it's working on, so that stuff, you know, could be hyper advanced in Asia, in parts of Asia, and the technology that they're working on over there to kind of surpass it. So obviously, it's good for innovation, right? It's good for, and I think that's largely the sentiment that I've read from people online, is that this is one of those cases where, you know, more competition obviously is, you know, usually results in more innovation. And so we can all kind of celebrate this, no matter how it kind of came to the forefront, no matter how it happened.
Yeah. Beyond the idea of competition, you know, what 5G is going to look like in the next few years is still being settled now. It is a global standard, which means different companies in different countries all have to come together in agreement with what it's going to look like. And you have a number of companies influencing what 5G will look like. Like I said, Huawei is a big player right now, spending a lot of money. trying to make sure that the 5G of its vision kind of becomes reality. Qualcomm is another big player. Qualcomm, Intel, Samsung, these are all other companies that have sort of vested interest in what 5G looks like. Mm-hmm. Just sort of looking at Qualcomm in the 3G, 4G era, you know, they've influenced a lot of where those standards are. And as a result, they were able to basically generate a lot of licensing revenue from people paying them for the rights to use that kind of foundational technology that's, you know, core to 4G and 3G. They want that to happen with 5G as well. And I think the White House, likewise, wanted a lot of that technology to come from America as opposed to being influenced by other countries like China.
Yeah. Is this, in your opinion, is this an indication of how the White House feels about that particular technology, protecting that technology, and then by extension protecting national security as a result of that? Or is this an indication of how the White House feels about Asian companies coming into the U.S. and buying American companies? Like, could we see this more happening more often in other ways?
It's hard to say. I would say this is more about protecting 5G technology. There's obviously, the White House has unusual interest in 5G. Sure. You know, there were reports that it floated idea of its own 5G network. So clearly, it's a priority to somebody in this administration. But yeah, in terms of like preventing Chinese companies from selling here, that I think is part of sort of a broader, more protectionist view from this White House, from this administration, as you've seen with the tariffs on steel and aluminum. I think that's more of, there's more of an overarching perspective for being more protectionist.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Roger Chang, it's great to get you back on the show. We really appreciate you taking time to talk with us. Roger Chang is CNET.com, and the rest of the team is out there having their Thursday afternoon drinks. So go have one, please.
All right. Thanks. Pleasure being here.
Take care, Roger. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Online porn continues to vex lawmakers, parents, and privacy advocates. And one big reason for that is that we don't like to talk about it very much. So let's talk about it. Joining us now is Louise Mitsakis, a staff writer at Wired, covering cybersecurity, internet law, and online culture. Welcome, Louise.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me.
So the piece you wrote this week focuses on online regulations about pornography and how difficult it is to keep pornography from children while also respecting the rights of adults. Talk a little bit about the current legislation that they're working with.
So I think before we kind of talk about the specifics of the legislation, it's important to know that they're kind of the brainchild of this crazy guy. He's like, you know, said he's addicted to porn. He tried to marry his Apple computer. He's, you know, been convicted of assault. He's harassed a number of people, including a 17-year-old girl. But state lawmakers have kind of ignored that anyway. And they've been considering this legislation that would basically make it so that minors could not access porn unless they went, put their name down, paid $20 per device and signed an agreement basically saying that they accept the risks of accessing pornography.
So this is Chris Sevier that you're talking about. And that was in the 90s?
No. So that's actually going through the state houses right now.
Oh, okay.
But I kind of make this comparison in my piece about how this happens all the time. So yeah, no, that bill is actually being considered in states like Rhode Island. It's being considered in Texas. Rhode Island was kind of the flashpoint in the last couple of weeks because the lawmakers there don't even seem to know what they're trying to accomplish. And they're just kind of like blindly like, yeah, we don't want people to access porn. Let's just like listen to this guy. But these bills have a really long history. Like, you know, starting in the 1990s with Bill Clinton, he signed a number of bills that were later deemed unconstitutional. I think that's important to note, that tried to restrict minors' access to porn. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, this is decades before 11-year-olds had smartphones.
Yeah, you point out in your article the Child Online Protection Act of 1998 was one of those that you're talking about, you know, deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. It used age verification by way of credit card authorization in that case. If that was shot down, what would make this approach so much different? It kind of seems born of the same thing, same idea.
It's not. They're really very similar, which is kind of the problem. And I think that if any of them were to pass in a state, they would face immediate constitutional challenges from the ACLU that would end up just being expensive. There's just this long, alluring desire to restrict minors' access to porn. And I think what I point out in my piece is that meanwhile, less than half of states mandate sex education. So that seems like a good place to start. If you don't want kids to learn about sex from porn, then maybe mandate sex education. They won't be so interested in learning about norms of sexual activity from, you know, online explicit material.
Yeah, I'm like the favorite mom at cocktail parties and other gatherings of parents, because I'm like, your kids have seen porn. They have. The average age is 7 years old. It's not, there's no, nothing you can do. There's no parental technology. There's no technology that you can do to keep them from seeing it. You know, seven is the average age kids are seeing it these days. So you got to talk to them about it, you know, which nobody wants to do. But I love that your piece really had that specific, specific statistic that 62% of females say they viewed porn in adolescence, and I guess 93% of males, and yet only 24% of states mandate sex education, as you said. So yeah, it's a little bit complicated. And so I want to bring up what you said, what part of the legislation was for people, if they wanted to view porn, they had to put their name on a list somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. As you said, would not be constitutional necessarily. But what are some other pitfalls of trying to legislate keeping porn out of the hands of kids?
Well, I think one of the problems is that it's not just on explicit porn sites. Like, it's not on just like a tube site or on like a site that's like actually for adult content. There's plenty of user generated porn on sites like Reddit and Tumblr. And it's not as simple as just blocking the like truly triple X, like hardcore pornography sites. And I think that you risk not being able to draw a line between things like sex education, LGBT content, and where does it really become porn? I think that especially on the internet, you know, there's a lot of like artwork. It's really difficult to decide where that line is. And it's, you know, we can't keep white supremacist propaganda videos off YouTube. I highly doubt that state legislators are going to be able to keep porn out of, you know, teenagers' hands. It just seems like such an insurmountable task.
So who is managing that, though? So I know in the case of the Rhode Island proposed bill, you know, there are these filters that that end up being applied. And I guess that always ends up being the question in something like this, right? Like the idea might be, it might be a noble cause to say, hey, we really don't want our kids viewing pornography. Let's not do nothing and let's do something about it. But when you enter the realm of applying filters, someone has to execute on those filters. Someone has to say, hey, these are the filters and this is what we do. But someone also has to determine what the line in the sand is between something that's, you know, let's say indecent content and something that's maybe educational, but, you know, somebody might find it indecent, whereas this person doesn't. Who's managing that?
I think so. The bills vary from state to state. They're all kind of based on the same basic premise and basic language. But in Rhode Island, I believe in particular, it's the burden is on the device manufacturer. So if you get an iPhone, in theory, these filters come pre-installed by Apple or by, you know, Google or whatever, whoever makes your phone. And I think in theory, they would be regulated by the states. But like, you know, like I said, it's just such an insurmountable task. I can't see any of these things passing. But it's just so fascinating that there is this such everlasting interest in trying to restrict the access, but they don't want to, say, fund a study or, you know, try and figure out what are the effects or figure out other ways to tell people about sexual activity. That's just never part of the equation. What they say that they're trying to do is stopping sex trafficking or trying to stop child pornography now it's trendy to say you want to stop revenge porn, but they don't ever talk about, you know, educating people on those issues. It's always just about, we're just going to divert funds away or something. Like, there's never, and the reason I think they don't never include those kinds of solutions is because they don't involve sex workers. They don't involve industry stakeholders. They don't involve like actual adolescents in these conversations. So that's why I think a lot of the legislation ends up being so tone deaf. Hmm.
Stoic Squirrel in our chat room says, I'd rather they try banning white supremacists first. It's a lot more damaging to society. They're a lot more damaging to society than porn. And you write that there's not any significant research out there that says pornography is damaging to children.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are like some preliminary studies that show that they inform how people think about sex. But I think that it would be great if you took some of these funds and instead of, you know, funneling them towards designing a content filter, if you funneled them towards, you know, figuring out some of that research. Like, I think there's so much you could learn from talking to kids about what they're experiencing and what they're learning. And I think that, you know, part of the sex education we should include part of, you know, sex education is just not about how to put a condom on a banana, but also, you know, what you might be seeing in porn is not necessarily real. I think we have to have those conversations with teens.
Absolutely. I'm also kind of thinking about the fact that right now, you know, more than a lot of times in recent internet history, you know, with the kind of the eradication of net neutrality rules, where we're at with all that changing, do you think laws like this have more, like, it's easier to fathom these kind of laws in the current mentality that it, that is this net neutrality ejection period that we're in right now?
I think because of some of the Supreme Court cases that came out in the 1990s, it's going to be really difficult to pass anything like this, even without net neutrality, because they're going to be deemed unconstitutional, unlike in the UK, which is already thinking about implementing some of similar regulations. Right. Because basically what it comes down to is that you're restricting adults' access to content that they have a First Amendment right to access, and you can't overburden their access to that. And that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that the internet has definitely become more vulnerable. And I think that, you know, states can do more to regulate this kind of content than they could have in the past.
You also write about MindGeek, and they're like the Amazon of porn now. Like they own Pornhub and they own YouPorn. They own everything. Like, and their argument was like putting a kind of technology, even though it's their technology, putting a technology in there might make parents think, well, then, you know, I don't have to do anything. I've got the you know, MindGeek is doing it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think MindGeek is such a fascinating company that a lot of people don't know about. Like, I think it kind of reminds me of how you don't know that certain magazines are owned by the same company. You know, like basically all of the major porn companies are owned by MindGeek, which is this Luxembourg-based company that's pretty mysterious and doesn't really talk much. I also think it's hilarious. They have horrible Glassdoor reviews. So apparently working at the giant porn company is really not that fun, which is really shocking. But yeah, that's kind of been the industry line for years, is that they don't want to take this responsibility because they think that it's a responsibility that belongs with parents. You know, parents should be deciding what their kids have access to. And what we should be investing in is building, you know, customer facing tools, not tools that are legally mandated, but, you know, tools that are easy to use for parents so that, you know, if you don't want your 7-year-old to be able to access porn for the first time, that there is some sort of filter. But that's something that you decide with your kids, is not something that your state representative decides. It's kind of their line of thinking.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. I mean, we always talk about, oh, this is so new, but it's the same argument about mm-hmm. sex education, really. Like, yes, as a parent, I know it's my responsibility, but there has to be something else, because all parents aren't going to fulfill this responsibility. And what is that something else without, you know, I don't know. It's a tough one. But thank you so much for writing about this article. Really interesting, really enlightening. Louise Matsakis has written for Motherboard and Mashable, and she is now a staff writer at Wired. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
We appreciate your time.
Bye.
Coming up, it's been a long road to nowhere for Theranos, and we'll examine what that means for other Silicon Valley upstarts. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform. We've all come to expect that distributed databases can't be both relational and scalable. But what if you didn't have to make trade-offs? What if you could have a fully managed database service that's consistent, it scales horizontally across data centers, and speaks SQL? Introducing Cloud Spanner, a mission-critical relational database service from Google Cloud Platform, built from the ground up and battle-tested at Google for strong consistency and high availability at global scale. Cloud Spanner delivers scalability, high transaction performance, and strong consistency across rows, regions, and continents with an industry-leading 99.999% availability SLA. No planned downtime, enterprise-grade security, multi-language support. You've got client libraries in C#, Go, Java, Node.js, PHP, Python, and Ruby, JDBC driver for connectivity with popular third-party tools. Pricing is simple, and it's also predictable. You can learn more about Cloud Spanner at g.co/getspanner today. That's g.co/getspanner. One more time so you don't miss that, g.co/getspanner. And we thank Cloud Spanner for Google Cloud Platform for their support. The rise and fall of Theranos has taken some time to materialize, but just yesterday, the Securities and Exchange Commission officially charged that CEO Elizabeth Holmes, as well as former President Ramesh Balwani, deceived investors in an elaborate and long-lasting fraud. Joining us to talk about the message that this might be sending to Silicon Valley is Aaron Griffith from Wired. How's it going, Aaron?
Hi.
It's great.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. We appreciate your time. Going kind of back to the beginning of this saga, first of all, what was the promise of what Theranos was developing way back when? You know, there was a lot of excitement around kind of the technology that they were producing. Explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the excitement was around the technology, but also I think a little bit around the idea that we really wanted to have this female Steve Jobs type character who suddenly managed to build a $9 billion company. There was a lot of hunger for promoting that narrative, even if it wasn't true, as we now know. But the product itself was meant to allow people to get their blood tested without requiring a huge amount of blood, which is necessary today for a lot of medical testing. Theranos claimed that they had developed a way to test blood using just a tiny little pinprick. And anyone who's had a lot of medical tests done knows that they take a lot of blood. So, you know, the value proposition was obvious. The problem was the technology never delivered on it.
Yeah, right.
So you write that the scale of the fraud is really nothing new, but that the forces behind it are new. Is that what you're talking about? The Steve Jobs?
The reverse of that is what I wrote. Like the scale is what makes it unprecedented. I mean, she built a company that investors valued at $9 billion. She had, you know, hundreds of employees. They had real customers. They had, you know, deals that they've signed with Walgreens that were based on fraudulent information. And she was on the cover of many magazines. And so that's the scale, I think, there is unprecedented, but the forces behind it are actually, you know, very, very common in Silicon Valley. And that is basically venture capital pushes entrepreneurs to deliver outsized returns, because that is kind of the model. Venture capitalists invest in these companies and they expect many of them to fail. They just need one to become a billion-dollar unicorn or much more so they can return their fund. And that's kind of how the model works. But that means they push every single company to think far bigger than what seems reasonable or achievable for normal business goals. And that means that they're under a lot of pressure, and that entrepreneurs have the opportunity to sort of think big and like maybe stretch the truth, and that can evolve into outright fraud, as we saw with Theranos.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that really kind of struck me in reading through your piece in particular, is this idea that there's a line between promise and truth. And in Silicon Valley, there is so much, you hear so many promises being thrown around and so many dedications to the fact that we are going to change the world with our vision, with our idea. There's no doubt that they believe that. They truly believe that at their core, that their idea is going to change the world. But at some point, where is that line drawn between what they're saying they can do and what they're actually capable of doing? We give them a lot of credit for what they haven't shown us yet.
And it's very difficult, I think, because it is inherent in the tech industry and in just in technology in general, that you are trying to create the future.
Right.
Technologists are trying to sell people on their idea, and that is something that does not currently exist, but they plan to build it. And this is the way that they believe the world will look in the future. And so, I mean, to use the cliche, they're trying to change the world. That is actually the goal here. And so, you know, that sometimes people are wrong in their way that they think that the world is going to evolve. And does that make them a liar? Not necessarily. And so I think that technologists, more so than any other area of the business world, get a lot of leeway in these kind of, you know, overhyped, overblown ideas that maybe don't quite work yet, but they will, because we've seen so many technological revolutions in the past that we don't want to just be the dinosaur who dismisses something just because it's not perfect today. But I think maybe that mentality has gotten a little bit out of control. And Theranos is the number one example of that getting out of control. But there are many smaller examples of that, too, in the startup land or in the startup world, some of which have gotten a lot of attention and some of which have been, you know, kind of brushed under the rug or painted as exceptions. But when you add them all together, there are a lot of instances of this. And I think it's very important for venture investors to not just encourage their entrepreneurs and their portfolio to think big, but also to encourage them to think honestly and legally and all of the things that are important with corporate governance.
So is there a way to do this? I mean, you know, what you're talking about is what Bill Gates said, you know, that we tend to overestimate how technology will change in the next 2 years and underestimate mm-hmm. how it's going to change in the next 10 years. And so mm-hmm. is there a way to do this without lying? And do the venture capitalists hold some of the, I guess, blame for this? I mean, for wanting, they want to see what's going to happen in the next 2 years. They want that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there's a way to conduct business without lying.
Good to know.
I think, you know, in Theranos's situation, I mean, the lies were egregious. There's a one part in the SEC complaint that says that they had told investors that they had 100 or they were going to have $100 million in 1 year in revenue and they only had 100,000. So that is, I mean, really, really egregious and not necessarily as bad as certain startups where they're maybe like fudging or projecting this overly hopeful or overly rosy way of looking at things. And one thing that's driving this trend is the fact that startups are going public, are waiting so long to go public now in this kind of age of the unicorns where there's a lot of late stage money rushing in to invest in companies while they're still private and it's not really forcing any of them to go public. They've all kind of avoided growing up. And going public is something that forces a company to be realistic about its numbers and think, okay, we're going to be under pressure. We need to become profitable. We need to have audited books. We need to have the so-called adults in the room who are, you know, making sure that we are complying with every single law. And I think, you know, if Uber had gone public a few years earlier, they maybe could have avoided some of these really dumb mistakes that we saw them making in the last couple of years that came out last year. And I think maybe some venture investors have seen these things play out and thought, okay, well, maybe we should push our companies to try to go public earlier, to try to get ready to go public earlier. I don't know, but I would like to hope because I think that's one easy way to avoid these kinds of problems.
Now, as far as Elizabeth Holmes is concerned, I think there's a $500,000 fine as part of this judgment. Does that fit the crime in this case? Like, is that enough? Is that a slap on the wrist? I'm having a hard time figuring that part out.
I've definitely seen some commentators saying that it just seems a little bit wimpy on the SEC's part, that they maybe should have gone after her a little bit more aggressively because she still does own some stock in the company. So in theory, if the company sold, she could earn money on it. They have to, the company would first have to repay all of its other investors. So it'd have to sell for more than $750 million. And that seems that's not going to happen. But, you know, they did allow for her to somehow keep some of the upside that, you know, could be seen as a little bit wimpy. And she's not able to sit on the boards of any public companies. She could still be involved in private companies, it seems like. So, you know, I think that's certainly debatable, but they are also being investigated, I believe, for I think that there's a criminal investigation going on still in California. So there are some there are still other ways that this is playing out. It's not totally done yet. This is only about fraud with investors and misrepresentation to investors. But there's still a whole consumer side that it's actually a lot more damaging. I mean, they basically were giving people blood tests that were not accurate or not reliable.
So I know there are companies like Uber are dealing with the taxi industry and companies, you know, like Airbnb are dealing with the hotel industry. And there's all these companies right now that are trying to disrupt. And so there are big, giant, established institutions that are ready to swoop down to try to defend themselves. Is that part of what's going on right now, too, that these big, established companies don't want to be disrupted?
I'm not sure what you mean as it relates to this, I guess.
Was there a similar, was there medical industry pushing this, discovering that Theranos was using bad science?
Yeah, I think this came from a few different places, but I think in general you're correct that certainly when an industry is being disrupted, they're going to look for holes in the disruptor's business. And one example of that was really clear was when Hampton Creek, the vegan mayonnaise company, was exposed for buying its own mayonnaise on the store to make it, or buying its own mayonnaise in the stores to make the product look more popular to the stores that were carrying it, which is just a very kind of bizarre little scam that they were running. Their first reaction was to blame this on Big Eggs and the egg industry, who was out to smear them. And I think, Uber has done a really good job of making an enemy out of the taxi industry as well, and positioning itself as an underdog. So I think we can see a little bit of that, but in a way it makes sense because these companies are following certain regulations, paying certain taxes. They have already established that they are complying with all of these laws, and then they see a disruptor come in and kind of flout them. I think it makes sense that they're going to say, wait a minute, why aren't we looking at these guys over here? And so it doesn't really matter where it comes from if the company is committing some degree of fraud.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and yet Theranos is still a company. Like, what? I'm just curious to know what are they even doing at this point? Are they just kind of sitting around waiting for this to all blow over so that they can then reinvent themselves again?
Yeah, I thought that would be very unlikely.
Yeah.
I would be quite surprised to see that, especially since we know that the technology is just not there. So if they don't have the executives, they don't have the technology, and the talent has likely fled, what value is preserved there?
Yeah, I appreciate that you've brought to light something I never knew existed before, and that is the idea of Big Egg. Thank you, Aaron.
you're very welcome.
We appreciate your time. Aaron Griffith from Wired. Thank you so much for hopping on today and talking to us about Theranos.
No problem.
All right,
thanks for having me.
You bet. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
Finally, the British theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking died at age 76 this week. Hawking was best known for his best-selling Exploration of the Universe, A Brief History of Time. And he was also known, as his children put it in the announcement of his death, known for his courage, persistence, and humor. Joining us to talk about Hawking and his legacy is Dave Gershgorn. He is a reporter, an artificial intelligence reporter at Quartz. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So talk a little bit about Hawking's legacy in terms of science.
Yeah, so Stephen Hawking has a very rich legacy in theoretical physics. Known for marrying, the largest theories about the universe with some of the smallest. And his book, A Brief History of Time, is incredibly well known. It was a New York Times bestseller for, I think it was like 4 years. So he has definitely contributed a lot to science as well as pop culture. I mean, he is known as kind of somebody who is a modern day physicist that was, pushing the boundaries in our time, in a time that information was shared quickly, and there was an opportunity to be rebutted. It wasn't something where, you had to, when papers were first coming out in physics, somebody could think about ideas for decades and have internal discussions. Everything was out there. Everything was debatable. There were new technological advances, and a lot of what he was saying held up over time. So he also kind of like made splashes in pop culture, and he was a communicator of science as well as someone who kind of took physics to a new place.
Now, in recent years, he was known for his questioning of AI, kind of coming out and saying, yes, there's a purpose, there's good to come of this, but we also need to be wary of it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Totally. So Stephen Hawking had like a really interesting relationship with artificial intelligence. On one hand, he used AI every day for the most basic tasks like communicating with people around him. His computer had a word prediction algorithm that was trained on his speeches and his lectures and his books. And it would, when he would type a letter, it would suggest the most likely word, a lot like the keyboard on your smartphone. So this is what really allowed him to type at a speed that was acceptable to him. For a few years, he was typing letter by letter, and it was completely frustrating. He would hit the wrong letter sometimes, have to go wait for the cursor to go to the next place where he could backspace. So this kind of these predictive algorithms really helped him and helped him communicate and kind of make his life better every day. And it's something that I think we can relate to. There are things like with Google, it's they have AI in their algorithm now, and we use AI to make our lives better. But he kind of had a very direct relationship with it. But I think since he's such a big macro thinker, he also saw the potential harm that AI could possibly bring to the world. I think he said that it could be the best or the worst thing for humanity. So I think he really cautioned against letting AI free to kind of optimize for whatever it wanted to. But I think that a lot of the news headlines that wrote about Stephen Hawking after reading and going through a lot of what he actually wrote himself kind of simplified what he thought about artificial intelligence. He really had a nuanced understanding of narrow artificial intelligence, which are things that the predictive algorithm that chooses the next word, versus general artificial intelligence, which is something that has a similar learning capability to a human, but at a computer data center scale. So I think, to be expected from someone of his intellect, but he really had spoken with a lot of people, it was evident, and read a lot of literature on it. And I think that he had a pretty nuanced idea of if the AI was let loose and it was the AI or human, there were only so many resources on the earth. And the AI would probably want it for themselves.
His voice carried a lot of weight on what we can expect out of a future when it comes to many things, but obviously AI is one big component of what he did a lot of thinking and a lot of talking about in the last however many years. You actually mentioned your article, and I read through a Reddit AMA from a few years ago. Hawking said that a recursively improvable AI, an AI that basically makes itself smarter and smarter and smarter in its own operation, will result in machines that are smarter than us, more than we are smarter than snails. That doesn't kind of put you into your own place, but that when I read that, I was like, man, that's one way to put it, and that's really kind of depressing. But at the same time, there aren't many thinkers alive now where the majority of people who hear or read his words put as much weight into it as we do and have through Stephen Hawking's work. I don't know who fills that void now that he is gone. Who kind of carries that flag moving forward to say it's really important that we get responsible about how we're developing these systems?
Well, I think specifically for AI, there have been a lot of organizations that have stepped up and started looking at the ethics of automated systems. There is an organization against killer robots specifically, and that's just robots and for autonomous warfare. There have been a number of academic research outfits that have cropped up, like the AI Now Institute, mainly at a New York university, led by Meredith Whitaker, and a researcher from Microsoft, and they are working on doing the social implications of AI, and it's like core research, like when AI is introduced to a system. What does that mean? How does automation change a society, whether it's predictive policing, whether it's, the criminal justice system, whether it's, predicting food scarcity, something, anything that an automated system can be kind of applied to. There's also a bunch of companies that are starting to look at this. DeepMind has an ethics group now that they published, you know, a blog post on bias just yesterday. And they're trying to look at themselves and create sort of like a better future. So I think that, and there's also the partnership on AI, which is a whole bunch of big tech companies that have come together to talk about this very topic, as well as how do we inform the public about this? How do we work together to create, you know, some sort of standard that the public can trust in an AI product? So I think that while Hawking was kind of seeing the future a little bit in terms of what could be possible in 10, 20, 30 years, now the industry has progressed to the point where they're starting to take the reins a little bit and represent themselves. So while Hawking was definitely someone who was able to reach a lot of people, I think that it's really now falls on the AI industry to kind of explain themselves and hold themselves or let themselves be held accountable by the public, who are increasingly starting to want more answers about the algorithms in their lives.
I think, as with so many things, we are often afraid of the wrong thing. And I think that that is true for artificial intelligence. Last week, it was the story of the, you know, Amazon Echo laughing at you. And the simple, like, technological right. answer for that was pretty basic. You know, it was very easy to say, you know, laugh and give the wake word. And people were saying it and it was laughing. Whereas we don't spend any time thinking about really what is the data that Amazon's collecting about us and, you know, what are we giving it and what is it going to be used for, that sort of thing. So I know that you regularly write about artificial intelligence, and there's a lot of stuff to sort of be scared of. But I mean, you're interested. You're obviously very interested in this, and you like it. So have you become more frightened about artificial intelligence as you're learning more about it, or less frightened? And what are the things that you really, like you said, you know, algorithmic, you know, inequality? I know you mentioned in your article, like how AI will affect wealth distribution. What are the things that you think are important for people to really be concerned about?
Yeah, there are two ways to think about it. And I think that this kind of reflects where Stephen Hawking's mind was on the issue, his take. He was a big macro thinker. He thought about, you know, if you're talking about the Earth as a zero-sum game, who's going to hold the resources on a, you know, or on a planetary level? But when you talk about research and when you talk about the actual incremental improvements that people are making in artificial intelligence, it's a lot less scary because you start to realize a lot of the shortcomings. You know, when you're talking about, okay, so this algorithm is deployed on a data center, it's confined to this, you know, these few GPUs, and there's, you know, nothing in its programming and there's nothing that it can learn that would cause it to go to other GPUs or another data center or, you know, kind of like escape its bounds, or how it even do that to be super intelligent. Anyway, it becomes much less scary. So I think I kind of fluctuate wildly on between micro and macro and whether we should be scared. I mean, and it's understandable why people are scared, because it's like, you know, there was a book that like Our Final Invention, where it's like, hey, I could easily be imagined as the end of humanity if it, you know, goes wrong. But I think that the chances of that are probably slim, but the potential risk would be great. So I think that there are two minds that can exist simultaneously on how scared we should be of AI. I think it's probably a lot more realistic or, you know, prevalent to the way that the world and the industry is developing to be more scared of what humans are doing with AI rather than what AI is going to do of its own volition. You know, we have, like I said, you know, it's how wealth is going to be distributed, how structural inequalities in our society are going to be encoded into these algorithms by accident, not necessarily on purpose, but just things that, you know, we kind of take for granted in our criminal justice system and, you know, in our economic system. And just like the way that we treat others is an example for machines. So if there's hate speech online, machines are going to learn hate speech. That was like the big kind of thing with Tay, right? Microsoft's rogue AI bot. Artificial intelligence has this incredible ability to be a mirror to to humanity. I mean, it's really reflecting what we give it. So if we, it's garbage in, garbage out. So I think that we need to be just really careful about what we feed these things. And I think that that's really what I look at most often, and what I'm worried about and think people should be thinking about, rather than, you know, whether Terminator is going to happen.
So we can see it more along the lines of the plot of Gremlins, for example, then.
Yeah, don't feed them after midnight. No water, right? Like, okay. That.
Got it. Dave, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure, as always. Dave Gershkorn is a reporter at Quartz. You can find his work at QZ.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, finally, Samsung, their latest flagship phone, the Galaxy S9, officially goes on sale tomorrow. That's Friday, March 16th. But if you were lucky enough to pre-order yours ahead of time, it's very likely that it shipped to you already. That is the case for me, and I believe that's the case for Leo as well. He got his as well. He got the Plus. I have the smaller S9 model here, and thought real quick, oh, we should show it off, although I'm noticing I didn't take that sticker on the side off. So oh. Those of you who enjoy peeling a sticker away from a phone... isn't that better? See, now it's all shiny there instead of, you know, wrapped in a sticker. But yeah, so this is the smaller S9. And I don't know, like I've only had it a little bit less than a day, but and we've already heard a lot about the S9 with the repositioned fingerprint sensor in the back. If you have the S9 Plus, there's a vertical array of dual cameras in the back. But I mean, you know, really, other than that, the device design is very similar to what we had with the S8. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of difference. But Snapdragon 845, which is kind of the modern high-end Snapdragon processor that you're going to see in a lot of the premium phones this year. This is the 5.8-inch Super AMOLED display. And yes, 3000 milliamp hour battery, IP68 rated. So on my vacation, I plan on swimming with this, perhaps in the ocean, and taking pictures underwater, because I can, I think.
Wow. That's what IP68 means? Like 68
I can swim
feet,
with it, yeah. Or? I can. No, it's just the rating. Okay. I mean, you go to Wikipedia, it has all the different IP ratings, and okay. 68 means that, you know, you can actually submerge this in water.
And it can take pictures underwater?
Yeah, you can. Wow. Yeah. If you can get the screen to respond while you're underwater, that might be the kind of challenge. Maybe there's a hardware way to fire it off with one of the buttons. I haven't tried that yet. But yes, so this is, you know, known to include the mechanically adjustable aperture between f1.5 and f2.4, which again, I haven't had much chance to really, you know, play with that in a targeted sense. I've taken some random pictures. I actually linked to an AR emoji that I set up. And I think it ended up looking kind of like me. I mean, that looks a lot like me, except for the swirly background.
If you say so.
I'm rarely surrounded. I mean, the hair's a little slick for me, I suppose. But the face, like, you know, it's kind of, I want to know how they're doing that. Kind of, sort of looks like me. I guess it's not animating for Victor. That's okay.
Oh, sad.
Yeah, I know. You're missing out on a lot without that.
We got to see your balloons you gave me before. There we go.
There we go.
So how does it compare to your Pixel?
Well, so far that's really hard to say because I've only had it for less than 24 hours. But I mean, I think from a feature set standpoint, I mean, you know, you're going to miss out maybe on some of the more Google-y approach. You're going to get a little bit of that touch. I guess it's not TouchWiz anymore, but Samsung's UI, which you got to be okay with. And I feel like Samsung has come a long way with their version of their overlay. You get this super slow-mo. This was, it was raining out in the backyard with a little sun. Oh. So I put on the slow-mo and you can see the tiny little drops dropping in super slow-mo, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, Leo took a slow-mo. What did he do with that? He took a slow-mo of me hitting you. Punching you.
Fake punching me. You never actually hit me. That slow-mo would have looked really impressive if you had actually hit
maybe
me.
That's why he
and
never
I was prepared for it. I would take a hit from you for
the purposes of excellent.
Well, and besides, it's your birthday, so if you want to hit me today, this is your one chance.
Okay. Good to know. Well, you said it felt small, but you have the small version, so.
Yeah, it feels, I mean, small. You were pointing out it's really not that much smaller than the iPhone X. Mm-hmm. So maybe I had a case on the iPhone X when I was using that. So maybe that's what I need to do, put a case on this and then it'll feel a little normal. But yeah. I'm just not used to the smaller form factor, even though 5.8 inches is not that small, but feels small to mm-hmm. me compared to the Pixel 2 XL. But yeah, so I'm going to play with this on my vacation and report back on it, I suppose.
Did we say how much it costs? Unlocked for $719?
$719.99 for the smaller one, and then $839.99 for the larger one. Releasing tomorrow, so if you didn't pre-order, you should be able to go into your carrier outlet or Best Buy or whatever and pick it up. You could also order it unlocked from Samsung, which is what I did, and that's what I have here.
So while you're up in the club over the weekend, take some low light pictures, because that's what it's really good at.
You know me so well, mm-hmm. Megan, me going to the club on the weekends. Mm-hmm. That's like every weekend for mm-hmm. me. So this is the perfect club phone, or so I'm told.
Yeah.
Or so Megan tells me. Mm-hmm. She apparently knows. Mm-hmm. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show by emailing us. All you have to do is send that email to tnw@twit.tv. And did you know the Twit Flash Briefing is now available in Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, and India? It's been in the U.S. For some time now. So if you haven't checked and you're in those areas, now is the perfect time to go into your app, the app settings, and under Flash Briefing, just look for Twit, and you'll find us there, and you'll get our Flash Briefings every day.
Mm-hmm. Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. You can find all the ways to subscribe. So whatever podcast catcher you use, it's there. You can subscribe to audio and video. And if you don't think you have enough time, we don't mind if you listen to us on the fast version, 1.5 or 2.
Sure.
You need your Tech News Weekly. And if you want to tweet at me to tell me how fast you listen to our show, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Patrick DeLahanty for scrolling words. Thanks to Victor for pushing buttons. Thanks to Burke for, he was in here tweaking cameras and yelling at us. So was Alex. Thanks to Colleen for making me panic there for a second. When she looked at me, I thought something was going on. But everything was good, and we really appreciate your help. And thanks to y'all for checking out another episode of Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all next week. Bye, everybody. Happy birthday, Megan.
Thank you.